All conditioned things are impermanent. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. All conditioned things are painful. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. All things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. So three verses from the Dhammapada. We've been hearing a few words from the Dhammapada over the last couple of mornings. So I thought it would be good to continue the exploration of that very fundamental text. And these are some of the most famous verses from the Dhammapada. And what they do is they introduce the three lakshanas, or the three marks of conditioned existence. So they say, or these verses say, that conditioned existence is impermanent, painful, and devoid of unchanging selfhood. So really, really, really fundamental Buddhist teaching, this. The verses also indicate the effect of engaging with the truth that they are communicating. So what it says is that if we see this with insight, then we become weary of suffering. So if we see that conditioned things are impermanent, painful, and devoid of unchanging selfhood, then we become weary of suffering. So I have to confess, this is Sangharakshita's translation, and I have to confess I'm not entirely sure why he translates that like that, weary of suffering. The words apparently is nibbindati, the Pali original for weary of suffering, which means something like disentangle. So another way of rendering it is, if we see this with insight, we disentangle ourselves from suffering, which I think for me is much more immediately apparent what is being communicated. And then it says, this is the way to purity. So one way of understanding purity is purity from the defilements, so purity from greed, hatred, and delusion. And spiritual death, which is of course our theme for this retreat, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, requires engagement with the three lakshanas. So if we're to spiritually die, we have to engage with the three lakshanas, the three marks or characteristics of conditioned existence. So this is an essential element. I don't think you can have spiritual death without this element. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to see these in our experience, or make an effort to see these three characteristics in our experience. And when that happens, that is spiritual death. That is insight, or in the fullest sense, if we really see this, that's insight or prajna, where we see through our mistaken perceptions, our ignorance, our delusion, and so on. So I thought Artabandhu actually evoked this really beautifully yesterday. First of all, the idea of it, so what it means, and what the lakshanas mean, but also the kind of experience of how we engage with that, and actually the experience of what it's like when it happens. So I thought that was really beautifully evoked yesterday morning. So in a sense, this talk, you could say, is just kind of a series of footnotes to your talk. hopefully it serves as such. And just in case we get complacent, the next verse after those three verses that I just read out goes like this. Just in case we're feeling a bit, you know, we feel a bit special because we're a bit young and maybe still a bit cute. So this is what the Buddha says. He says, "One who does not make use of his spiritual opportunities, who, though young and strong, is lazy, weak in aspiration, and inactive, such a lazy person does not find the way to insight." So pretty direct, isn't it? And then one of the characteristics of the Dhammapada is just really direct. It's like, okay. So anyway, I just thought that would be fun to have that little verse as well, just in case we were getting a bit complacent. So how might we make use of our spiritual opportunities? How might we do that? You know, this retreat is a spiritual opportunity. So for a lot of us, we're not going to get on retreat all that much. So this might be one of two or three or six or seven, I don't know, retreats that we might do this year. So it's a real opportunity, actually, being on retreat. Really good conditions. And Padmaloka is a really, really great place to be on retreat. It's like we're plugging into a whole history and atmosphere and community of retreat going. So it's a real opportunity. So one way we might make use of our spiritual opportunities is to reflect on the three lakshanas. Or, we could put it, reflect on our experience in the light of the three lakshanas. So Dharmashala yesterday afternoon, I think it was, mentioned the three levels of wisdom. So there's wisdom through listening, wisdom through reflecting, and wisdom through meditating. So one of those is reflecting. So just reflecting on our experience in the light of the three lakshanas. And we've got an opportunity within an opportunity, in as much as we're having a bit of silence. And again, on retreat, when you're in silence and you've been doing quite a bit of meditation, you build up the kind of energy that's really conducive to reflection. I don't know if you've noticed this, but I've certainly noticed it myself. It's like the kind of frivolity of the mind that we usually have just due to the level of activity that we're engaged in just kind of dissipates or slackens off, and there's just more space, and the mind's a bit more creative, a bit more supple and pliant. So the silence represents an opportunity within an opportunity to try and see our experience, to see the world, to see other people more as they really are. So what I want to do now is just look at each of the three lakshanas just for a little bit, just so we're kind of clear about what they are. So the first one is that all conditioned things are impermanent. So the Pali word is anicca, which literally means not eternal. So what this is saying is that no thing, no phenomena, no experience anywhere stays the same, is permanent. So everything is in flux. Everything is a constant flow. Or another way of putting it is that all that arises will cease. So this means change. Constant ceasing, constant arising, constant endings, constant arisings. And I think it's really important that we recognise that it's not just endings. So I think that the fact that it's impermanent already kind of makes us think, oh, well, everything ends. But what this also means is that there's always new beginnings. And I think it's important to remember this, particularly because I think we live in quite a nihilistic, materialistic, almost sort of pessimistic age. It's important that we remember that it's not just that everything ends, but there's always new beginnings. Any moment there's the possibility of something new to emerge, any moment at all. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. And at the moment, we're experiencing proof of that. It's spring. So often, autumn and winter are associated with impermanence. But spring, actually, is just as much part of impermanence as autumn or winter. It's part of the cycle of the seasons that rolls on year after year. So it's new beginnings are part of impermanence. So that's impermanence. So seeing that everything changes, or nothing is permanent, nothing stays the same. So the second lakshana is all conditioned things are painful. So the way this is usually put is that because all things are impermanent, they aren't capable of providing complete fulfillment. They might be all right insofar as they go, you know. So sometimes you notice this in relation to food. If you're just a bit hungry and you eat some food and you feel satiated, it's like, you know, that's all quite innocent. But when you want food to give you something more than what food can give you, it becomes unsatisfactory. Sometimes I notice this on our retreats in Dublin, and the last night we have chocolate biscuits. And sometimes it's sort of like you start looking forward to the chocolate biscuits because you haven't had them for a while, and you think, oh, a chocolate biscuit. But usually what happens is when I eat it, it's actually not very, you know, it's pleasant, but it's actually not as good as I expected it to be. And there can be a slight tinge of disappointment. Things are, because they're impermanent, if we relate to them as having something more than what they really have, then that is painful. So conditioned things are painful. And if we disentangle ourselves from suffering, if we see that as it really is, they're just unsatisfactory, is another way of putting it, then we disentangle ourselves from suffering. If we're not expecting something from them which they can't give us, then we're not going to experience suffering. I think this is really, really worth reflecting on, actually, that if we actually realise that conditioned things are unsatisfactory, they're not unsatisfactory anymore. It's quite interesting. And that's actually, if you read it literally, that's what it says. So all conditioned things are painful, dukkha. When one sees this as insight, one disentangles oneself from dukkha. That's literally what it says. So it's quite interesting just to reflect on that. Okay, so moving on. I've got a little bit more to say about the next one, which is all things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. When one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. This is the way to purity. So this is the famous not-self doctrine of the Buddha, so anatta. And it has to be said that I think often this is misunderstood. And again, I think it's often misunderstood because of our particularly sort of nihilistic worldview, a lot of us. So some people say, I've heard people say this, Buddhism says that you don't exist. People say that sometimes, you know. Buddhism says that you don't exist. That's what the no-self doctrine is saying. And I think what's going on here is there's kind of like a kind of hijacking of Buddhism by a kind of nihilistic attitude. It's not actually saying that. Well, it's saying that we don't exist in the way that we think that we do, but it's neither saying that we exist nor that we don't exist. It's actually, you know, in the middle of the two. So what it's saying is there's no fixed, unchanging core to us or to any phenomena in the world. There's no fixed, unchanging essence. That's what it's saying. It's not saying that either that things don't exist or that things exist. It's saying that they don't exist in the way that we usually assume that they do. Now, there's another way of putting this, which I think is really helpful, which gives a little bit more of a connection with what this is really trying to communicate. So what this doctrine is saying, the not-self doctrine, is that it's not that we don't have a self, it's that we always have a new self. So it's not that we don't have a self, it's that we always have a new self. So I got that little phrase from a very good talk called A Taste of Freedom, which Sangha actually gave in the early 80s, late 70s, sometime around then. It's really good, and he uses this phrase, which I think is really interesting. So we are remaking ourselves anew at every moment. So we've always got a new self, always. Each moment we've got a new self. So now the self that we had, you know, yesterday actually doesn't exist. We've got a new self. There's obviously a continuity, but we do have a new self. So when one sees this with insight, one becomes weary of suffering. So in relation to this characteristic or this lakshana, this means taking control of how we are remaking ourselves. So in other words, becoming creative. So that's what it really means, becoming creative. So actually entering into that process of remaking consciously, intelligently, kindly, and so on. And I think what this indicates is that insight is not a static thing. We often talk about getting insight as if it's like, you know, you go down the road and you pay your 20 quid and you get insight, you know what I mean, like a sort of can of insight or something like that. And it's, you know, kind of language kind of impels us to talk in that way, you know, so and it's not a bad thing. But I think the problem is we often think about it like that. But it's actually not quite like that, I don't think. How can you get something which says that there's no things anywhere, if you see what I mean? It's a kind of contradiction. If this particular lakshana is saying that there are no fixed things anywhere, or no core, well, how can you get something which shows you that, if you see what I mean? And I was really brought up against this when I got given the name that I have. My name's Jnanadhara. So jnana is roughly synonymous with prajna or insight, and dhara means to hold. So I'm the bearer of insight or wisdom. And I remember thinking, well, hang on a minute, what can I actually hold? You know what I mean? If insight is seeing that there is nothing to hold, well, what am I holding? If you get what I mean. So this is a sort of bit of a personal koan, I suppose you could say. Like, how can you hold something when there's nothing there to hold? Which is precisely the thing that you're supposed to be holding, if you see what I mean. Anyway, that's just me sharing one of my own personal problems. So, next time you say my name, you'll have a little bit more sympathy for me. I don't know. So there are two possible ways to remake ourselves. Two possible ways that we remake ourselves. One way is that our new self is just like the old self. So in other words, we remake ourselves in the same way that we were before. So it's a new self, but it's just the same as the old one. Or the new self is an improvement on the old self. Yeah. So that's when spiritual development is taking place. The new self is actually an improvement on the previous self. So we have to die and be reborn. We've no choice in that. That's the nature of things, death and rebirth. That's nature, as it were. But we can influence the way that happens. So if we influence it positively, that is a spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. So spiritual death is the old self is let go of, and spiritual rebirth is when a new self grows out of the old self that's fuller, wiser, kinder, etc. than the old self. So that's spiritual rebirth, as opposed to just rebirth, if you get what I mean. It's a little bit like the image that's often given as a snake shedding its skin. So in order to grow, a snake actually has to shed its skin because the skin is too small for the snake to grow. So it actually has to let go of it, and then a new snake kind of wriggles out of the old skin. So that's the process that's going on all the time. So another way of talking about what I'm talking about now is mind reactive and creative. So we've probably heard this before if we've been around the True Ratna Buddhist community for any length of time. So it's the same mind, our mind, your mind, but it can function in two radically different ways. So we saw this in the Rumi poem that we heard the other night. So we can walk down the same street, fall down the same hole and wonder how we got there, or we can walk down a different street altogether and maybe even forget about the hole completely. Yeah. So there's two different ways of living. And the really kind of difficult thing, the really scary thing maybe, is that we can't not act. So it's not like I don't want to do either of those things actually. Is there another option? There actually isn't. We have to remake ourselves. What we are is the sum total of our actions. That's what we actually are. So we can't not do that. That's just what we do. But there is a choice in the manner in which we do that. And that's the really crucial choice. Okay, so what I want to do now is just tie that in a little bit with the stages of integration and positive emotion. So we've looked at that a little bit in terms of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth. Well, what about integration and positive emotion? And like Lakeshvara was saying a couple of days ago, it's not a linear thing. This it's not like you do one, then the next one, then the next one, then the next one. It is like that, but it's also a kind of like a cumulative thing that each one feeds into the other ones. And if you go into any one of those stages, then the other stages are revealed. So let's just have a look at it in terms of integration, positive emotion. So on Friday morning, Lakeshvara said, the stage of integration, we could call it mindfulness. He said words to that effect. So integration is about mindfulness. And he defined mindfulness as watching what you do, think, and say all the time. That's what mindfulness means, or endeavouring to do that. Maybe we can't do that all the time, but at least we can endeavour to do that. And there's another aspect of mindfulness as well, which is, so mindfulness is not just about watching. Mindfulness is also about knowing. In particular, knowing what your mental state actually is. So kind of understanding the quality of it. So this is the Pali term is apamada. and it has this connotation of actually knowing the quality of your mind. Another, to be more specific, knowing whether your mind is reactive or creative, actually knowing that in any given point or time. Really important to know this. It's often put in terms of skillful and unskillful. So reactive more or less relates to unskillful, and creative more or less relates to skillful. That's the language we often use. So we need to know actually what our mind is. Is it skillful or is it unskillful? Is it creative or is it reactive? And here, the stage of integration kind of blends, so to speak, into the stage of positive emotion. So again, Lokeshwar said, you know, positive emotion is love. So love, you could say, you know, the word we often use in the Buddhist context is metta or maitri. And positive emotion, the stage of positive emotion, includes all the other positive mental states, skillful mental states, creative mental states, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, shraddha, etc. So what this stage is about, the stage of positive emotion, is bringing skillful mental states into being, bringing creative mental states into being. That's what we're trying to do in this stage. So hopefully you can see how I got there from mindfulness. So you might think, well, why bother being creative? So let's just sort of not assume that that's a good idea, but actually let's just say, well, why would you want to be creative? What's the point, so to speak? And this is one of the things the Buddha says. And again, this is a really famous, it's probably again one of the most famous verses from the Dhammapada. And this is how it goes, the first two verses. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, reactive, unskillful, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, creative, skillful, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So the point of it is to gain freedom from pain and the experience of happiness. That lies in the mind. So I think usually we think being happy is about getting all the stuff that we want, making things work out the way we want them to work out. But actually, according to the Buddha, happiness and pain, the root of that is in the mind, which is a completely different way of thinking about it. It's really worth, and this is one thing that's really, really worth reflecting on, is, well, how is that true? Or, it, you know, you could reflect on, well, is that true? Let's not assume it's true. Is that true? So it requires a kind of investigation of your own experience, sort of delving into your own experience. One little aside, actually, is this is a little aside. The Buddha doesn't say whose pain or happiness. He just says, if one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows. He doesn't say, like, your suffering or somebody else's suffering. I think, so actually... I've checked a good few translations, and it doesn't say you're suffering. It just says suffering follows you. We tend to think, well, I'll suffer. But actually, if you're unskillful, other people are going to suffer too. And if you're skillful, if you're creative, other people will experience happiness, you know, in your sphere of influence. I think it's really, really worth reflecting on that in your own meditation. If you can't be bothered to cultivate skillful mental states for yourself, well, you can think about cultivating them for other people, and that can bring a whole new dimension to the practice. I think Sangha Nista said this the other day, that, you know, there is this altruistic dimension of practice, whether we're conscious of it or not, it's there. And I think it's quite interesting just to reflect on that as well. Okay, so how might you go about doing it? How might you go about doing creative mental states, cultivating it? Mental states. So the clue is in the first part of those verses, which is experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. So we can start with the mind. And meditation is the mind working directly on the mind. That's one way it's sometimes put. So you're actually working on doing just this, creating skillful mental states when you meditate. So one definition of meditation is, meditation is an uninterrupted stream of skillful mental states, or, you know, the effort to cultivate an uninterrupted stream of skillful mental states. So if you're in an uninterrupted stream of skillful mental states, you're in jhana, you're absorbed, is the way you sometimes put it. Sometimes I think we talk about concentration, and dhyana is when we're concentrated. And I think concentration is an interesting word, because it can very often have a kind of negative connotation. And it really was reminded of this when Sanghanista was talking about his religion teacher. That thing, you know, you've got this big buxom teacher who sort of tells you, concentrate! And you're like, do you know what I mean? It's kind of quite forced. And you might be quite concentrated, but it's very forced and narrow. And I think sometimes, you know, when we talk about concentration and meditation, we can get sort of a wrong end of the stick, that it's all about being very tight and very willful and very forced. So sometimes I think absorption is a more evocative kind of word, which suggests that we're kind of joining up the different aspects of ourselves, or even integration. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to join all the disparate parts of ourselves into a stream of skillful mental states. So that's what we're trying to do in meditation. So sometimes, and one thing I've been doing recently is just asking myself the question, well, if that doesn't happen, when I meditate, if I don't experience a stream of uninterrupted, skillful mental states, well, why not? That's a question I've been asking myself recently. Well, what's the problem? What's holding me back? And I've been keeping a little meditation diary and just writing two lines, like, okay, I meditated. Well, did I get concentrated or did I get absorbed? It's like, if the answer is no, well, why not? And I've been quite ruthless about it. And very often, almost always, the reason I'm not concentrated, hang on, I haven't finished yet. The reason I'm not concentrated is because I'm in one of the five hindrances. And it's a bit shocking, actually, just because you can look back then. I look back at my diary and say, oh, you know, I experienced, I did that there and I did that there and the day before, and think, okay, well, there's a pattern here. And I feel like it's kind of honing that aspect of mindfulness I was talking about being kind of knowing the mental state. I feel like it's kind of honing that or making that a bit sharper. So I say, well, this is what you're doing, Yanadhara. And it's a bit like, well, do I want to do that, you know? So it's something I really recommend, that actually. You don't have to write screeds and screeds, but just write, you know, if you experienced a hindrance, what was it? So just to remind you, if you're not familiar with the five hindrances, it's a really useful little kind of list, really. So the first one is desire for sense experience. So this is where we're kind of sitting there fantasizing about some pleasant experience that we'd like to be having. That's basically the gist of it. We're preoccupied with something that we'd like to be doing that we're not currently doing. And sometimes it kind of we do this as a compensation for the fact we're not really experiencing much pleasure in our meditation. But the question that's really worth asking is it actually pleasant? And what I find myself is, if I'm sitting there in a state of desire for sense experience, there's an awful tension, because I'm not really with my experience. I'm somewhere else. So there's this horrible kind of tension, and it's actually not very pleasant. That's the conclusion I've come to. So it's really worth just asking yourself the question, like, if you're in that state, it's just, is this actually enjoyable? Is this actually pleasant? Do I want to be doing this? Just sort of considering, you know, the effect of what you're doing. Anyway, moving on. Ill will. Ill will is really perverse, because what we're doing is we're preoccupied with something painful. We're actually rehearsing something painful in our mind, which is really, when you start thinking about it, it's really dumb. It's really stupid, because we're actually, you know, just running over something which is painful. It's a bit like we've sort of got a sort of a pin and we're just sort of stabbing it into our arm. That, you know, that's actually what we're doing. It's just painful. It's really painful. So you usually some kind of grievance. And I think it's quite good to just reflect on the fact that actually, okay, I can keep doing this, but I'm just going to cause myself a whole lot of pain. So that's ill will, preoccupied with painful, usually some kind of grievance, some of where we feel aggrieved. Restlessness and anxiety. So we often experience anxiety. So why is this? Why do we experience anxiety? So sometimes I think we experience restlessness and anxiety because we're overstimulated. So I think this is quite a common scenario. we're just doing so much with our lives that when we sit down, it all kind of just bursts into our mind. You know, we sit down and it's like, what would you do? There's all this sort of stuff, all this experience kind of, you know, that hasn't had any time to be processed. It's kind of flooding into our mind. So I think that can be the case. We sort of, it's really hard to sit still with all this activity. But it's interesting that restlessness and anxiety is often translated as restlessness and remorse. And this, the word is kikucha, which means something like regret. So this is actually more traditionally the way of understanding it. So we're actually, there's something that we're uneasy about, something that we've done that we're uneasy about. It's kind of like our conscience isn't quite clear. There's some kind of murk, there's some kind of tension somewhere. And I think it's quite good to remember that is part of restlessness and anxiety, this hindrance. And this is, of course, where ethics relates to meditation. If we're not ethical, then you know our conscience will not be completely clear, and that'll affect us when we meditate. So I haven't talked about ethics, but obviously ethics is a really, really important part of both, you know, integration and positive emotion. Really important part. So yeah, so that can be a good question to ask sometimes. If you're feeling a little bit uneasy, well, maybe there's something that you know that you've done that you regret. You know, and actually, again, knowing that can help to move forward. Just being clear about, well, what did I do? Just being quite clear about it. We don't have to feel guilty about it. This is a really important thing. We don't have to feel guilty about it. And if we can put our finger on it, exactly what it was, it can be a real sense of liberation that, oh, okay, well, I just told a lie. I mean, I did it for certain reasons, but that's what I did. And you could just, you know, maybe you need to apologise. Or maybe you just need to tell a friend, oh, actually, I see something, I shouldn't have done that. And it's like, then, you know, that's it. You might experience the consequences of it, but you're not going to give yourself a hard time. You don't have to beat yourself up or anything. We do this all the time. It's really tragic that we do it, but we do it. So that's restlessness and anxiety. Sloth and torpor, the body is heavy, the mind is dull. So that's sloth and torpor. I don't want to go on about it, but, you know. This is what it, you know. This is what it looks like. So I'm sure you all know this sort of thing. The last one is doubt, which, you know, in that same talk of the Taste of Freedom, Sangharakshita kind of characterises doubt as vagueness. So it's a kind of willful refusal to make up our mind. And I think it often underpins our other mental states. It's a willful vagueness about our mental state. We don't really get clear about whether it's a hindrance or whether we're in a creative state or a reactive state. We just sort of stay vague. So our meditation is just kind of vague. We don't really want to know. We don't really want to engage. So I think this is what I've noticed about, you know, doing this meditation diary. One of the things I've noticed is actually I've kind of got this resistance to actually being clear. Because, you know, it's not very nice to sort of think, oh, okay, sloth and torpor, all that was ill will. But, you know, actually, you know, that's what I need. If that's what's going on, I need to know that. Otherwise, I'm not going to move forward. So I think it's... Yeah, doubt is it often underpins other negative mental states. So it's useful just to know this list and just to kind of almost just try and understand your own mind in this kind of way, so that you know where you're starting from. It's really crucial. It's not, and I did emphasize this. It's not that you've now got you know five new sticks to beat yourself with. And I think we've got to be really careful about this. That we say, I'm just an ill will again. I'm such a terrible person. You know, it's actually not about that. It really isn't. It's about, there's a real sense of freedom, I think, that comes in knowing, okay, that's what I'm doing. Oh, great. I can do something about it. I know what's going on. It's really not about giving yourself a hard time. Just want to make that really clear. So it's about understanding. It's not about self-flagellation. It may be that we just don't know what our experience is. I was talking the other day, I did a retreat, led a retreat last weekend over the Easter break, and somebody said, but sometimes I don't know what mental state I'm in. And sometimes that's the case, isn't it? You're just all kind of churned up and you don't know what's going on. And in a way, that's all right, you know what I mean? It's not like, oh God, I don't know if I'm in a hindrance or what's going on. And that's one of the really good things about just sitting. So just sitting, we've been doing a bit of just sitting. You can just sit with it. Just sit with whatever that is. It might be a pain in your heart. It might be it's sort of a strange sense in your belly. It might be some kind of thought. It might be some kind of emotion. You just really don't know what it is. And rather than kind of trying to kind of stick a plaster on it or label it, just actually kind of try and explore it. Just go into it. Just sort of, sometimes I think the best instruction for just sitting is just relax. just relax into your experience and allow it to sort of unfold. I just wanted to say that because I don't want people sort of obsessing about hindrances. And also, I think it's important that we have a positive orientation for meditation. So I think it's quite good just to reflect on the desirability of absorption, the desirability of dhyana. So it's interesting that in the tradition, there's these different traditional objects of mindfulness. There's the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the breath, and one of them is the devas, the shining ones, the gods, and their experience is said to correspond to the state of jhana. And I sometimes wonder if that's the point of it. It's if you just contemplate the devas, you contemplate the beauty and the value and the happiness of jhana, and then you're more likely to sort of enter into it yourself if you've got a positive feeling for it. And another thing to say is, I've been talking about the hindrances, but it's also really important to recognise the positive factors in your experience. Recognise them when they arise and try and give your attention to them and cultivate them. So qualities like spaciousness, openness, commitment, interest, peace, you know, calm, tranquility, enjoyment, warmth. But it's really good just to notice them when they arise. And that often I find that, I'm starting to feel calm. Great, I'll just sort of relax into that. You know what I mean? So it's not just about getting rid of something bad. It's about, you know, the positive emotion is about creating positive mental states. So noticing them when they arise and giving your attention to them. So, all of this, creating positive emotion and integration, creates the conditions for insight, for spiritual death, for knowledge and vision of things as they really are. And they really are indispensable conditions, I think, most of the time. That's certainly the way that the tradition talks about them, you know, that we need integration of positive emotion in order to enter into spiritual death. So that we're really experiencing our experience. Arthur Bandel was talking about this yesterday. So we're actually with our experience. We actually know what it is. We know the texture of it. It's not an idea. We're not alienated. There's an immediate connection with our experience. And when we're absorbed, that's what it's like. You're really there. You're just there breathing, for example, if you're doing the mindfulness of breathing. Or, you know, there's that famous bit of line of verse from T.S. Eliot, you know, we are the music while the music lasts. So the line before that is music heard so deeply that is not heard at all. So you know when you're really inside music, it's like you're just music. It's not you listening to music. And that's what, when you're absorbed, that's what the experience is like. We're just there. We're just there. There's no sense of a split. Now if we reflect on the lakshanas when we're in that state, then there's a possibility that we actually see, oh, this is changing. My breath is changing. It's not like there's me, which is fixed, relating to my breath, which is fixed. There's this relationship. There's this flow. So that's why the lakshanas are important, to reflect on them, because they kind of precipitate that experience of spiritual death, that true seeing. So if you want another reason, you know, this is another reason for cultivating skillful mental states, is they provide the conditions for insight. Another important condition, and here I'm going to start telling a little story now, because I know it's been a little bit conceptual. I apologise for that, but I thought it was good just to kind of go into these things. Hopefully, you'll find it useful. So another really important condition, if we want to gain insight, if we want to spiritually die, if we want to be free, we have to let go of what we think we know. So we have to let go of what we think we know. At least relate to it as provisional. So all of our present understandings, all of our present ways of looking at things, we have to hold them lightly. If we hold them too tightly, they're going to stop us from going deeper. Now again, Arthur Bandy mentioned this yesterday, this thing that we actually kind of, in a way, prejudice our experience with the views that we bring to it. So we have to kind of try and let go of the assumptions that we already understand, we already know. So Padmasambhava, there's a picture of Padmasambhava right there. He says what we need to do is we need to constantly remind ourselves, I do not know, I do not have, I do not understand. That's what he says. I do not know, I do not have, I do not understand. That we've got to keep need to remind ourselves that. Because we actually think that we really get it. This is a really strange thing, but we really think we understand what's going on. We have all these assumptions. And it curtails our ability to actually see what is really going on, because we're just relating to it in terms of what happened yesterday, what happened the day before, what we'd like to be happening, what we assume is happening, but it's not actually what's happening. It's almost like we need, it's almost like the innocence of a child. Now, I don't want to romanticise childhood, so I don't mean innocence in the sense of, you know, perfectly ethical or anything like that. And also, like, you know, there's all sorts of horrible things about childhood, like complete powerlessness, for example. Like, some people think, oh, geez, I wish I was 14 again. I'm just like, the powerlessness of it, is something that I think, well, it doesn't attract me. So I'm not trying to romanticise childhood, but in childhood, there is this innocence and a sense of wonder. So all is new and fresh. It's like everything's new. You haven't seen anything before, so it's all new. And we're not expected to know. We're not expected to know or understand. We don't expect that of ourselves even. We expect to learn new things, to sort of have new experiences. Well, it's almost like when you're a kid, you're kind of getting ready for life. Life hasn't happened yet. You're kind of preparing for it. So we're allowed not to know things. We're allowed to be open to learning new things. So just to sort of demonstrate this, I want to tell a little story. And I want to return to that image of the ocean that we had yesterday. So when I was a kid, we lived quite near the ocean. I'm from New Zealand. And everywhere in New Zealand is near the ocean, pretty much. Not too far away. And where I grew up in the north of the North Island of New Zealand. There's lots of really beautiful beaches. Heaps of them. And it's really, really lovely to go there. And that's what people in New Zealand do. They go to the beach an awful lot. So every weekend in the summer... Now, this is my memory. It probably wasn't every weekend, but it feels like that. Every weekend in the summer, we would have a family trip to the beach. So we'd get everything ready, all the towels and suntan lotion and all the rest of it, load it into the Toyota station wagon that we had. Dad would be in the front. Mum would be in the driver's seat. Me and my two sisters would be in the back. The dog would be in the boot. It was a station wagon, you know. Don't get me wrong here. So, if there was another person, I'd probably be in the boot with the dog. and it was a real ordeal to get there. You know, horrible dusty roads. Like a lot of the roads at that time were just gravel roads, really dusty and really windy. So, I'd often feel quite car sick. So it was a real kind of ordeal getting to the beach. But when getting there was absolutely thrilling. It was like, that's the only word. It was absolutely thrilling. So I remember you'd burst out of the car and you'd run down to the beach, and it always has these sand dunes. So you'd kind of run out and you'd jump off the end of the sand dune and just jump into the soft sand. It was just brilliant, you know. So you're there at the beach after this horrible bloody ordeal, sort of feeling slightly sick, and there was always sort of some new experience. Every time there'd be a new experience. You'd sort of learn a new game. You'd meet a new friend. You'd catch a wave that you know really big wave, or you might find an animal, you know, like sometimes, you know, one time we found an injured penguin and we put it in a little tea box and we took it to the RSPCA, and that was a real little adventure, do you know what I mean? Or there'd be the endless fascination of rock pools, of just discovering new little animals, like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen a sea cucumber, but there's these fascinating animals and they're all different colours, and sea anemones and all this type of thing. So there's an endless discovery and fascination. And the interesting thing was the outward form was always the same. Same dusty gravel roads, same car, same sort of feeling of slight sickness in the stomach. And then you get to the beach, same sand, same water, same swimming togs, same waves, same blue sky, same fluffy clouds, same bacon and egg pie, same mum, same dad, same sisters, same ice cream on the way home, same melting ice cream down my hand, same fish and chips when we got home. So it's always the same. So the outward form was the same, but the experience was always different. So I never used to tire of it. It was always thrilling, this sort of sense of newness, of discovery. And I think that's what we need to learn. We need to learn to do the same old things, but try and see newness in them. A bit like a kid at the beach. So trying to have the experience of newness. And actually, you know, taking delight in them. So I think when my meditation is going well, I get this kind of sensation that it's like all this experience that I every time I meditate, it's like I learn something. It might be a little thing, like I just recognize that I new kind of positive experience that I hadn't experienced before, I hadn't put my finger on. A little bit like, you know, coming back from the beach with a kind of a shell that you'd found, a beautiful shell or a beautiful rock or something. So I think this is what we need to do, this cultivate this ability to do the same things again and again, but relearning that sense of kind of newness or freshness or wonder. I think it's a really, really crucial quality, and I think it's part of what this process is about, remaking ourselves anew. So I'm just coming to the end now, and I just want to finish with the image of the ocean and a few thoughts about that. So here we are again with the image of the ocean, and it really feels like when you go to the ocean that you kind of get in contact with something deeper. So that the ocean is massively deep, it's massively powerful, and it's just enormous. So when I was in New Zealand in January, and we flew from Los Angeles to Auckland, and you fly over the ocean for 13 hours, going at about 500 or 600 miles an hour, and you really get a sense the Pacific Ocean is really vast. Like, because you literally, you're just looking down, and there's ocean, you know, for 13 hours. It's absolutely massive. And I think, you know, I think one of the really great things, why being at the beach is so wonderful, is I think being near vastness is good for the soul. Now, I mean this in using the word soul in the poetic sense, because obviously the Buddha says we haven't got one. In the technical, philosophical sense, but in the poetic sense, you know, we do have it. And I think, being near vastness, I think, is good for the soul. And I imagine what it was like for the monks of old, being by the Buddha. It's like being near this ocean. And there's in the Sutra of Golden Light, it actually describes this kind of experience of being with the Buddha and the Buddha being vast, like an ocean or an earth or a mountain or even the sky. So this is what the Sutra of Golden Light says. Just as the water in the ocean is immeasurable, just as the earth is endless with its particles of dust, just as Mount Meru is endless with its stones, just as the sky has an endless limit, so indeed are the Buddha's virtues endless. So I think it's really important to try and get some kind of sense of the Buddha in this kind of way. The Buddha is this sort of vast mine of treasures, or this sort of vast ocean of virtues. And I think actually it's great having the rupa there, because I think it kind of gives that kind of impression. Pai is really big. And there's a sort of big presence. And it really kind of adds a sort of sense of something much, much bigger in our experience. And it's interesting that the Dharma is also likened to the ocean. So the Buddha says in the Udana, another famous early text, just as the great ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, just so the Dharma has but one taste, the taste of freedom. And he goes on to actually describe 8 different qualities of the ocean and the way the Dharma is the same, like these 8 similes. So the Dharma too is this vast ocean that has the taste of freedom. And he also says, one of the 8 things, he says that just as a great ocean is filled with enormous mysterious creatures, so he says whales, leviathans, he even says whale eaters. So, you know, obviously at that time they didn't have much of a sense of marine biology in the way we do these days. So there's all these, you can imagine the sense of all these mythical creatures being in the ocean. And of course, you know, the Buddha and most of his disciples would never have seen the ocean. So it's this kind of, this sort of mythic realm that they were relating to. So the Buddha says, just in the same way that the ocean is filled with these great beasts, these great creatures, the Dharma is filled with great spiritual beings. It's this sort of swimming around in the Dharma. Like, I really like this. So the Dharma is this kind of field, and there's all these spiritual beings swimming around in it. And in our community, we have great beings swimming around in it. So Lakeshva referred to this the other day, that just, you know, it's really wonderful to be part of a community where people have been practicing for 30 and 40 years. And people do have real spiritual qualities, knowledge and experience, and we can learn from them. So I think this is, again, another really important condition in terms of spiritual death. It's just being in contact with the Sangha. And like a lot of these guys who've been practicing for a long time, they're really keen to help, actually. They're really, really keen to help you. And what they do, it's not just about being in contact with them in terms of being in contact with the Sangha, but they keep us in contact with the vastness of the Buddha and the Dharma. So sometimes it's hard to get that kind of connection yourself, but when you meet somebody who's more in touch with it than you are, you really feel that connection. So it's really, really crucially important. And I was thinking a little bit like, just in terms of that story I just told, like when I was 8 years old, I did not have the means to get to the beach. So yeah, I had to rely on my parents to take me there. And I think it's a little bit like that when, you know, when we're starting out in the Dharma. We haven't got the means to really access the vastness of the Buddha and the Dharma. We need the Sangha as a kind of, to sort of take us in the Toyota Corolla and drive us there, so to speak. We need that. So we need to be in contact with the vastness of the three jewels, the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. One of the reasons, there's lots of reasons, but one of the reasons is just to remain open to a sense of possibility. So we do not know how things are going to work out. So this was really apparent when we were giving our little stories last night, that both of us, we didn't really know how things were going to turn out, but they did turn out. So I think sometimes what stops us from committing is I think, well, I don't know how this is going to work out. We're not prepared to commit until we know what the end result is going to be, kind of in particular, in quite clear defined terms. But the fact is we can only really commit to the unknown. We don't know how things are going to work out. We just need to remain alive to the possibility that there is something out there, that there is a new way of being. And if we stay in contact with the three jewels, we'll have a positive sense of being able to let go into that. It's like we're not letting go into a vacuum, we're letting go into something very positive. We none of us know how that's going to work out, but it will work out. That's my conviction. Yeah, so we can only really commit ourselves to the unknown. And if we commit, there will be a gateway that will open. So it's said that corresponding to each of the three lakshanas, the three characteristics, there's a gateway to liberation, that the moksha mukhas. Artabandhu yesterday referred to it a portal. It's like there's a portal that opens. So if we engage with the lakshana of anatta, or the fact that all conditioned things are devoid of unchanging selfhood, the shunya, the moksha mukha, opens. The shunya gateway to liberation, or the empty gateway to liberation. So this is complete freedom from all fixity, all sense of things being fixed. It's like, I think what it means is it's what we do is we have this experience of constant arising. We never see anything as fixed. We just see this constant arising. So spiritual rebirth happening all the time. So this isn't an idea, this is just our reality if we enter into this gateway. Always newness, always freshness, always new possibilities for freedom. So that's the shunya for moksha mukha. So I just wanted to finish by reading you again a couple of verses about the supremely worthy from the Dhammapada. And just finish with this. So this is what the Buddha says. Those who do not accumulate material or mental possessions, who thoroughly understand the true nature of the food they eat, and whose range of experience is liberation through the realization of the empty and unconditioned, their path, like that of birds in the sky, is difficult to trace. He whose impurities are extinct, who is not attached to food, and whose range of experience is liberation through the realization of the empty and unconditioned, his path, like that of birds in the sky, is difficult to trace.